Good afternoon. Because it's afternoon. So yesterday we talked about the all you need to do is sit straight, remember? And the importance of just returning to this moment, being present with who it is. So maybe, is there still someone out there? No.
Okay. Sure. There's the priest and there's the volunteer
okay.
who came.
So. Okay.
Okay.
So now it's been 24 hours. Can we assume that now everyone is sitting straight? Everything is clear. No more questions. Hearts and minds awakened, dropped off. There was dropping off body and mind. Right? I don't think we can assume that. And we don't need to assume that. And I won't assume that. It doesn't mean that we haven't evolved since in the past 24 hours. We've been sitting all this time, so of course things change. The weather has changed, although it was kind of like this yesterday at this time, and then it shifted in lots of rain. Things change, as we said. We have another person with us today, Krisha, so welcome. Things change, right? And so maybe something we could say is we could move on from the step of just sitting straight and returning to this moment and say, okay, who is sitting straight? Who is returning to this moment? Who is having a pain? Who is tired? Who is eating? Who is listening to the rain? Because that's our center of attention is usually that. So, who? And who is also the key to unlocking that 45 minutes of grace, 45 seconds of grace that we mentioned. You know, we have this with with our koans, or most of them revolve around that, of who. The first one, of course, is mu, which some of you have heard of, others not. We look into what is mu. The monk asks the teacher, does a dog have Buddha nature? And the teacher says, mu. The teacher being Joshu, he says, mu. So when you work on this koan, your question is, what is mu? What is he talking about? Why does he give that answer? And we treat it like I said. So what is mu now? What is mu feeling pain? What is mu sitting? What is mu eating? What is mu in the rain? What is mu in the sunshine? What is mu cleaning the toilets? What is mu going to the store? What is mu at any moment? And then we're asked to demonstrate our understanding of that. So we come to the teacher, and the teacher says, so what is mu? And we're asked to demonstrate how we understand that, our experience of it, or something like that. That's just a basic look at what koans are and how we work with them. So when I suggest to you, you say, okay, so who is feeling this now? Who is feeling? We had this issue of Philippa brought up this example of, you know, when you're annoyed with someone. So, who is annoyed? Who is feeling that? Who is feeling the tightness? Who doesn't like that person? And this is a different way of looking at the situation than what we said yesterday. This is like a step further, maybe. Because what we're pointing at with who is you, who you truly are, your true self, your true nature, not who you think you are, or who everyone else thinks you are, or the labels that we've put on ourselves. So it can be nationality, you know, French, American, Portuguese, Spanish, all of that. It can be age, it can be gender, it can be sexual preference, it can be habits of eating, it can be profession, it can be position in family, it can be married or not, all of these things that we label ourselves as. But none of them are who we truly are. None of that is who we truly are. Which is why it's, you know, not easy for us to meet who we truly are, because we're so caught up in all those other things, who we think we are, who we think we should be, and who everyone else thinks we are. And we kind of touched on this yesterday, but so I wanted to come back to it today, because it is really the, you know, the key to our our practice, really the core of it. It's the main question. Who am I? That was my question when I started this practice, so I have a special affinity with it. In fact, I didn't start this practice with that question. I had that question before I came to the practice, and when I had an experience of that question, of what we might call a real resolution of that question, is what brought me to this practice. So for me, it's fundamental, but it is for all of us. I've seen I've worked with many, many people on this question. And it's one of the classic questions throughout all the Asian practices, whether it's Hindu, Vedanta, Buddhist. Classic question, who am I? And it even in the Christian tradition, or any of the Judeo-Christian practices, it also is important, because, you know, we're looking into, of course, we have this notion of God, which is outside of us in the Judeo-Christian. But when we truly realize who we are, we realize who God is. And Christ points us in that direction, telling us that. So all of the great spiritual traditions point to this who. And as I said, we have many koans around this. I decided today to pick one that is a famous koan, and we work with it sometimes. It's in our curriculum of koans, which is long curriculum. It's quite advanced. It's in a very late collection. But we talk about it a lot, and you may have heard me talk about it before. And Miguel even has his Dharma name is from this koan. So the title of the koan is Rinzai's True Man of No Rank, although in the more contemporary translations, it's True Person of No Rank. It's not about being a man, of course, obviously. Because this was such a patriarchal culture, and women were not generally considered practitioners seriously, and they weren't in the monasteries, it said man. But Rinzai was a Chinese master, I forget what century, ancient China, and was the founder of one of our branches that we hold in our lineage, the Rinzai tradition. So this is his True Person of No Rank. So I'll just read it to you, and then we'll look at it. Rinzai instructed his assembly, so he's sitting there like this, except in the traditional monastery, he's sitting higher up. There's usually, you know, a vast assembly of lots and lots of monks, and he's sitting higher up. So he instructed his assembly and said, "There is one true person of no rank, always coming out and going in through the gates of your face. Beginners who have not yet witnessed it, look, look." Then a monk came up and asked, "What is the one true person of no rank?" Rinzai came down from his chair and grabbed the monk. The monk hesitated, very surprised. Rinzai pushed him away and said, "The true person of no rank, what a shit stick you are." So a shit stick is, in this ancient culture, they didn't have toilet paper, right? So it was some kind of utensil that they used to clean themselves. And of course it was washed and dried and cleaned after that, but that's what it was. So when Rinzai says this true person of no rank is always coming out and going in through the gates of your face. The gates we could think of, you know, as our sense organs, like eyes, nose, mouth, ears, tongue. Those would be the gates. But it's also the gates, every pore in your body, anything you can think of as entering and going in and out is a gate in this context. So what is going on here? Rinzai says there is one true person of no rank. Usually in our culture, like when we talk about the labels that I mentioned of who we think we are, those are ranks. So you're the older sister or the younger sister, you're a sister to a brother or another sister, you're a certain age, which is older than another age or younger than another age. You are a senior in the Zen community. You're a beginner. He even says, beginners who have not yet witnessed it. So he's saying there's beginners and there's not beginners. In a monastery with monks, there's lots of hierarchy. Here there's, you know, supposedly I have this really high rank, a rank that you don't have. Everything, we usually think of ranks and steps to arrive, to become, to put ourselves in a position in relation to others and in relation to the world and the universe even. So, you know, we think of humans as being better than ants. I learned that, you know, there was this discussion when we were unpacking the food, and apparently there had been, the place where the food was stored, mice had gotten into it. Don't worry, we didn't eat any of the food. We chewed into a bag of pasta, right? And when Nuno was telling this story, he said rats. And I was really surprised. I thought, wow, there's rats and rats, you know. That looks like a tiny little nibble for a rat, you know. And then he said, oh, no, but in Portuguese, the word for mice is, what, little rats or something?
Rat.
What?
Rato. Rato versus ratazana.
What?
Rato. Mouse. Ratazana.
Big, right? Okay, so we have ranks of rats and mice. And, you know, that's how we always think of things, right? And primarily we think of ourselves as that. We think of ourselves as being little, not important, or really super important, or we want to be really important, or we want to be not important. It's endless. It's endless, endless, endless. The ranks, the positions, the categories, the labels that we put on ourselves and on others, therefore. And it's true in our worldly world, we need to have those identifications, and we need to have we need to know that there is someone who can fix a car, and there's someone who can cook food. We need to know that this plant we can eat and that one we can't. We need to know the difference between the little rat and the big rat. Whatever we call it, we need to know, and we need to make these distinctions. Right? However, when we're talking about this person of true rank, of no rank, this true person of no rank, we're talking about your true self, the true essence of things, the essential nature of things, in which there are no ranks. There are no steps. Everything is one. It doesn't mean that everything is the same. You know, that's the danger of attaching to this position of the true essence, of the absolute nature of things, is that if we attach to that, well, we're then right back where we were, saying this is better than the relative world. And we miss, we overlook the differences of the relative world, which are essential. We need to see those differences. If we don't, we become totalitarian. We want everyone to be the same. We want everyone to eat the same, look the same, and if they don't do it, we eliminate them. We know that we eliminate them from, you know, whether it's migrants in our, you know, current culture. I heard, you know, every place I go, I hear about the problem of migrants. It doesn't matter the country. It doesn't matter, you know, the way that it's dealt with, but migrants are, nobody wants them, right? Get out. They're different. You know, an amazing thing is, so in the United States, where everyone is an immigrant, except the indigenous people, who were there before all the rest of us, but all the rest of us came from somewhere else. And the two presidential candidates, so Kamala Harris, her father is an immigrant from Jamaica, and her mother is an immigrant from India, right? Donald Trump's mother is from Scotland. She's dead now, but so she was not born in the United States, Donald Trump's mother. And his father was born in the United States, but his grandparents were immigrants from Germany. So here we have these two presidential candidates who are really recently Americans. Unlike, you know, I can very proudly say my family arrived in 1666, which is true. My original ancestors came to America in 1666.
And can run for president.
Yes, well, see, both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump can run for president because they were born in America. And that rule was put in place to keep out the immigrants. And that rule was put in, you know, like in the 18th century when the country was founded. But they didn't want anyone who wasn't born in America to become president. So, but everybody was already an immigrant, right? So you see how deep this is. That even if your grandparents were immigrants, so, and Donald Trump is Mr. No Immigrants, right? His mother was an immigrant, and his grandparents were immigrants. And still this is so deep. We don't want someone who isn't like us, because we don't see who we truly are. If we do see who we truly are, we see that everyone is like us. Okay, they maybe eat different food, and they have different religious practices, and they have a different color of skin, and they speak a different language. But they are like us, because there is no difference on this level of the true self and the essential nature. They're just different manifestations of the same. So I can tell you all of this, and our practice is about clearly grasping this. So when you hear my words, and probably somewhere it resonates, you know, and you think, okay, well, that makes sense, but. And our practice, therefore, is a way of cultivating this, of the clarity to grasp this, to experience it for yourself, to experience this true person of no rank yourself. Sometimes we call it your original face. So that comes from another koan, which is, what was your original face before your parents were born? So, you know, you could ask Donald Trump, what was your original face before you put on orange makeup and your parents were born in Scotland and to German immigrants? So, what is your original face? Or your true self? Before a thought of good and evil, that's another koan. Who are you truly before a thought of ordinary, holy, sacred, profane, young, old, Buddha, ordinary person? Before all that, who are you? That's who the true self is. That's who the true person of no rank is. However, you know, I can explain this koan to you, and I can tell you all about it and comment on it, but you have to realize it yourself. There's no way around it. So this monk comes up, and you know, Rinzai says this, and he's saying beginners because, you know, he's hoping that there's somebody in there, in this assembly, who doesn't have fixed ideas about the question. You know, like Suzuki Roshi said, in the beginner's mind, anything is possible. In the expert's mind, there's not many possibilities. So Rinzai is addressing the beginners and saying, look, look, you beginners, you don't yet have a fixed idea about who you are. Of course, they do, but maybe less so. So this monk comes up, and Rinzai is telling them, you know, there is a person. There is a true person of no rank. And, you know, in a sense, he's saying all of you are that true person of no rank. It doesn't mean anything unless you realize it. You know, Miguel walks around with this name on his rakusu. Is it true person, true man of no rank?
True man.
Yeah. But it's still a koan for him. He constantly has to be looking, well, what is that true man of no rank? It's not different than my Dharma name, which is you are that. So I'm constantly walking around with this, wondering, okay, well, who is that? And it's not I am that, it's you are that. So that's even another shift, but you are that. You are the true person of no rank. You know, it's another way of saying you are Buddha. Sometimes Dogen says that, who I mentioned yesterday, Master Dogen, says Buddhas see Buddhas and other Buddhas. Ordinary people see Buddhas and ordinary people. So when you see your true nature, when you see the true person of no rank, you see true people of no rank. There's no way around it. It just, you cannot see otherwise. It doesn't mean, however, that you don't see the differences, because then you haven't truly seen the true person of no rank. So sometimes we say with this koan, you have to see the true person of no rank and the true person of rank, which sounds like a complicated thing, but it actually means you have to see the ranks. It just means you have to see the differences. However, if you see only the differences, then you're not really seeing the true person of rank. Because the true person of rank has no rank. I know this sounds like Zen jargon, but believe me, it's true. It's true. You know, it's like I say, I sit in this seat not because I'm extraordinary. Someone has to sit here, and I accept to sit here. I can let go of, you know, I can drop off the ranks and the positions. If I didn't, I wouldn't be able to sit here. If I was attached to this rank, I couldn't do it. And you wouldn't be sitting here, because I would be a completely different person. I'd be behaving completely differently. if I was attached to this rank. So it's possible to be a true person of rank and also a true person of no rank. In fact, you can't be one without the other. So the, you know, the monk comes up and says, what is the one true person of no rank? Sometimes it's there's another translation which is, what about this true person of no rank? So he's stepping up there and he's saying, I'm the true person of no rank. What about it? In this one, he's saying, what is the one true person of no rank? Well, you know, if he's doing this, you know, he's asking a question. You know, this is a legitimate question. And he's asking the question and he clearly hasn't realized it, right? So Rinzai responds directly, which is what we are all asked to do, is respond directly to a situation. So he comes down from his high rank to meet the monk at his rank and grabs him. He said, you know, this is, you're the true man of no rank. You know, he's grabbing him. It's in your face, man, you know, you're it. Monk hesitates. Rinzai pushes him away. You yourself are the true man. You know, he's, you know, the true person of no rank. You're it. He's pushing him away. You're it. But he's then moves into, what a shit stick you are. You lousy monk. Which is, you know, this is kind of the traditional thing that, in the traditional Zen, you know, the old school Zen, they insult you and they tell you, you know, how lousy you are. But it's a way of provoking then maybe, oh, wow, yeah. So is there a difference between the true man of no rank and the lousy monk? You know? The lousy monk is the true man of no rank, but he doesn't see it. Lousy, do you know that word, lousy? You know, you silly monk, you stupid monk. They're one. They're one and the same, but monk doesn't see it. Maybe he got it after that. I don't know. We don't know the rest of the story. It stops there. Maybe the monk was like, all right, of course. So you need to you need to see it clearly. Myself, I passed this koan with the teacher of my teacher in a Dokusan, and so, you know, you can imagine this was kind of impressive to be like in a Dokusan with the teacher of my teacher, who was this big, you know tough guy Zen teacher, and could be kind of scary, you know. But it was a very powerful experience for both of us, I think, passing of that koan. In that situation. Because you have to demonstrate your understanding. You have to, and when you have realized it, you know, when you see, when you've grasped, as we say, or when you see the true person of no rank, then it's not difficult to manifest it. Of course, you know, we don't manifest it every single moment. Of course, we do manifest it every moment, but we don't realize it. Sometimes we forget. That's why I say, you know, Miguel, he has to, like, have that koan all the time. And when I give Dharma names, it's because I think the person needs that koan. So, you know, I gave original face to someone. I gave perfect way to someone. I gave 10,000 things to someone. You know, I give these names because that's what I think is appropriate for that person. and then they take it on as a koan. Any of those koans could be appropriate for anyone. You know, they have meaning for everybody. So the true man of no rank, meaning for everyone. Perfect way, meaning for everyone. I don't remember what's... I didn't give you your name, but what is it, the name?
It's the Chief of Israel.
And what is it?
It's Gensen. Yeah, it's lots of... It's something that goes back to the original face and things like that. I mean, it's many... Because Gen comes from Ugan, so there is this, is the handoff, and that is already meaningful. I know it's too many things, I never really, let's say, I see it so big, that basically is a yogi guy that can deal with the situation and has to see his original face, basically.
Sounds a bit like the true man of no rank. You know? You know, yeah. Well, and gen has different connotations, as seen in Japanese.
Yeah.
Like my teacher, Geno, that's, and her teacher, Genpo, and Bernie, Tetsu Gen. That gen is all the same, and I don't know if it's the same as the gen in yours.
Well,
whatever.
I can show you.
Interesting. So you see, we have these names that we walk around with, which are another label, right? And once we have done this, you know, and we've received a Dharma name, when we come to the Dokusan with the teacher, we're supposed to say, no longer, my name is Amy, my name is Tue Sera. My name is, you are that. So when, you know, any of these people come with their to the interview, they say, my name is their Dharma name. Which is already a step away from the identity we have of our given name and who we think that is. Because that is also very charged. This name we've received and this identity we have around it. So receiving a Dharma name like that is a way of kind of shaking the tree a little bit, shaking us a little bit away from that fixed identity, so that we can maybe, you know, have a better glimpse of who we truly are. And of course, in the traditional, you know, he uses this formulation too, a true person of no rank. Because in traditional society at that time, there were lots of ranks. You know, whether it be in government officials, social status, monasteries, even within, you know, the Zen world and the practices, you know, there's different ranks of bodhisattvas and different steps on the path of realization and all kinds of steps and ranks. And so he's pulling the rug out from all of that and saying there's a true person of no rank. None of those ranks apply to this true person, who you truly are. So, any questions, comments? Also about yesterday, if anything came up since yesterday. I myself can't really remember what we talked about yesterday. I remember, you know, what? Yeah, we. Oh, yes, that's right. It was the Day of the Dead. Oh, and something I learned since then, I saw last night, is that Michelangelo's frescoes on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel were unveiled on November 1st. I think 1516. Does anyone know? Mm-hmm. Or people? No. I think it was 20, I don't know. But it was November 1st. Another interesting occasion, you know, which is representing man and God and not quite touching. Has anyone ever seen this? Yeah, for real. Unfortunately, when you go there now, it's like you have like much space and you have 5 minutes. And you're
acting, lie.
Yeah.
Like the picture of God with his bottom. Have you seen that one? Perhaps you've seen that. You see God flying and you see it from the back and you see his bottom. It's incredible. That one. It's very zen.
What?
It's very zen. God with no rank.
Well, you know, Michelangelo, he was kind of subversive too sometimes. Well, and I read somewhere once that the, you know, the image that he used for, I can't remember if it's God or for man in those frescoes, was of his lover. I can't remember his name, the guy's name. So maybe it was God's butt. It was his lover's, I don't know.
Maybe about the koan. When the leader shook the monk, I heard inside to me, you cannot be who you are, who you cannot see you can be. Like, I cannot be, because this is, I'm trying to know me better. So I cannot, even if I really am me, I don't know who I am. If I cannot see it, I cannot be it. Like, if, I don't know if I'm explaining.
That's exactly true.
Okay.
That's very true. I mean, okay, so it's true in the sense that you are always being it. You are always being your true self, but you don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so then when you say, if I don't see it, I can't be it, so you can't fully, freely manifest it if you don't see it. You're manifesting some kind of, you know, idea of who you truly are. All the while, that is who you truly are. You know, so the lousy monk, that he's truly the true man of no rank there. But he doesn't see it. I know that sounds confusing. Because words are always limited, and they can only describe and form a concept. Whereas what we're talking about is an experiential reality, experiencing who you truly are, without all those labels. before all of that, so when we come here. I know people who I've practiced with for 30 years, you know, and I know like intimate things about them, and we have deep relationships, and sometimes I'm not even quite sure what their last name is or what they really do for a living, you know, because I have a completely different relationship with them in on a practice level. We're relating to each other on a different level, and that's a way of helping us to pull away from all that stuff we do out there, the positions and the ranks and everything. And we come here and we're all the same. That's the idea of wearing all the same clothing when there's robes, shaving your heads. That's what monks do, that kind of thing. So that everyone is the same. And we're not attached to those ranks in the same way. So what you say, it's exactly true, and I don't think when you said it is what you meant. When you said, if I can't see it, I can't really be it, right? You said that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. Maybe not in the way you think so. I don't know. Am I interpreting something there? And
I don't know. I just said it when I was thinking. I haven't explored it.
Anymore. It's exactly it. But that's exactly it.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't see it, you can't be it. Although, like I said, you are being it all the time without seeing it. And when you see it, then you be it in a different way. You be who you truly are.
In what way does a koan function to help you see who you truly are? Who you truly are?
Well, because the koan, you know, it's an active questioning. So, you know, so it would be like, you know, it would be like if, you know, so we both had the question, who am I, right? So I would say to you, well, tell me who you are, you know, and you would say some stuff, and I wouldn't respond, and you would just keep saying, you'd keep asking, well, who am I, and you would say your name, and your age, and what you do in your life, and how you feel about things, and all kinds of stuff, and then we would switch, and you would ask me, and I would do that too. And we would keep doing that all day. Mm-hmm. And we would become really exhausted and fed up and bored, maybe even, and frustrated. And yet we would keep doing it. Until at some point, what we say, the bottom falls out, and we realize that none of that is who I am. But we have to go through it all and exhaust it all. And it's hard to do that by yourself, because when you become bored with it, or you feel like you already know all this, so, yeah, well, I know all this already. Or you become frustrated, and then you give up, and you do something else. Whereas with the koan, because it's this structured thing, and you're expected to come to the teacher and say what has come up for you, it's like the equivalent of having someone sitting across from you. You come to the teacher and say whatever it is, and then the teacher will say no, probably, and then ring the bell, but may ask some other questions, which then helps you to dig deeper. So it's about digging, digging, digging. That's what the koan helps you do. It's like a tool to dig and to eliminate them. Oh, I had this idea about it. Oh, she says it's not that. Okay, try something else. It means you have to really trust the teacher. And in order to trust the teacher, you better find a teacher who's done this themselves. Because if they haven't, bad news. They don't know what they're talking about. And they won't know how to help you, you know, dig. It's like, you know, a yoga teacher. You're not going to go practice with a teacher who's never done yoga or is only partially trained. Or, you know, your students come to you because they think you know what you're doing. And theoretically you do, right? So the koan then helps us to dig, to inquire, to question, and leads us to an experience beyond beliefs and opinions and ideas, concepts. Which is really hard to arrive at otherwise. There are many, many, many techniques and processes and practices mm-hmm. that help us do that. This is just one. Mm-hmm. You know, I think probably if you recite the mantras 300,000 times, like the lamas tell you to do, and, you know, you do all the, you know, innumerable bows that they ask you to do, and devotional practices, there are other ways of coming to it. But those are also practices about, you know, discipline and devotion and hard work. And koan practices like that too. But it's a different approach. It helps us to open to a glimpse of absolute reality. And then have an experience of it, which is different than reading a book. You know, supposedly all of these collections exist in books. You can read all of these koans. Supposedly there are even, you know, collections of answers to the koans. They're meaningless. You know, like, I've given you the answer to this koan, like, since I started talking. But that's not your experience. You have to experience it. One of my Dharma brothers, Frank Roshi, once he and his brother both practiced, and when we were all students together, and we were at a month-long retreat, and His mother was curious about what her boys were doing, you know. So she came. She was very Catholic, you know. She came to the retreat, and she stayed for 2 weeks. It was amazing. She stayed there for 2 weeks. And at the time, Frank's brother was working on the Koan Mu. And at one point during the weeks that she was there, she did everything. She sat through the Dharma talks. She did the work practice. She sat on a chair during the meditation, everything. And at one point, so she said to her son, Gottfried, who was working on the Koan Mu, Roshi had, my teacher, had at some point given a talk on Mu or something. And so she said to Gottfried, you know, I don't know what your problem is. You know, why are you struggling so hard with this koan? She just tedded the whole thing around. <the Dharma talk. laughs> I really don't understand your problem, you know, because he was struggling and frustrated and whatever. So, you see, you can hear it and think you get it, but that's not the same thing as experiencing it. And Gottfried knew that. You know, his mother, maybe on some level, she realized that. And he probably told her that. But it's not the same thing. You have to realize it for yourself. You have to manifest it yourself. So, that's what koans do.
Roshi? But then we forget.
We do, yeah. That's why we have so many koans. We do, absolutely. Yeah.
But yeah, I think I never this. I think this true nature. It now I'm thinking it's about emptiness.
And so then what is emptiness? You know, then we.
Of ourselves, the ranks are just we collectively functioning. I don't know, and we. I don't. Can I ask what who you are? I can.
You can, of course, yes.
And I'm thinking, am I alive just manifesting now and now and now and now? But I don't know. It feels a bit.
That's why we say keep
half
looking.
Theoretical, half. Yeah.
Yeah. We say stay with it, keep looking. So then, yeah, so you come and you say, oh, I think it's emptiness. And then I say, well, what is emptiness? And then you have to look at that. You know, when we say that, because often, this is often what happens, we come with this, yes, it's emptiness, or sometimes people come and they say, okay, so...
But the emptiness yeah, of well, ourselves.
Right, but what does that mean?
It means all, I'm thinking of me as in ranks or feelings, or I don't think of myself so much in a rank. But I think you also told... We can do this to ourselves with feelings or emotions.
And what do you mean?
Yeah. I feel that I'm not as good as or as lovable.
Yeah, absolutely.
We can...
And then that's still a rank.
Yeah. That's still a rank.
Yeah.
Oh, those kind of ranks are, for me, are more...
present.
Lucy.
No, it's what I most believe they are my true nature, and they aren't.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
See, so that's a good example.
Yeah.
So then, yeah, you have to look at that.
But when I try to look, or when I think, or feel, I get a glimpse. I lost it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I forget
because it's very. Fleeting, yeah. Because immediately the it returns, you know,
yeah. Right?
The grasping, the ranking, the attachment to who, what we're used to and familiar with. Immediately.
And because it's not completely clear, I think.
Yep, true, you, that as well, yeah.
You see it.
That's
bit,
why you have to deepen it. That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's the 45 seconds.
Right. Like yesterday we talked about 45 seconds of grace, yeah.
When you do the inquiry, where am I with another person or something, there is no danger of going out of our minds and being disrupted psychologically?
Well, so that's why, you know, I don't recommend Zen practice for people who don't have a stable sense of self.
Oh, okay, that's what I mean.
You have to have someone who's psychotic or has, you know, an unstable psyche. I don't recommend it. And I don't think any therapist or psychologist would recommend it either.
Sometimes we are not in that category, but what? Sometimes we are not labeled as psychotic or something, but we think we don't have a stable identity, and my fear is that. What can happen if I start to interrogate deeply? What am I? What am I? What am I? I'm afraid of going out of my mind. That's what I want, but...
That's what you want?
To go out of my mind is what I want.
Okay.
But I don't know if getting what I want is what I want.
When you say going out of your mind, so we're not talking about a psychotic break or something.
No.
But it does mean, it's true, that everything we have thought before...
frightening.
And that is frightening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, Teresa says, so it goes away and the old thing comes back.
Mm-hmm.
Because this not true self, we'll just call it that, this self that we're identified with, its existence depends on you not seeing who you truly are.
Mm-hmm.
If you see who you truly are, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least its prominence is gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer the master of your being. So it really clings because it, you know, its existence depends on you not realizing who you truly are. So it's a fight, in a sense.
It's a fight.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it can cling to some madness or something. That's my fear. That the clinging comes to the madness or something.
Could be. Okay. Yeah.
Can't we just realize who we are without being questioning that hardly? Because... She's afraid of going mad because she's asking, when I? But sometimes we just realize we are just by sitting here or by just being.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ask the question without being, you know, oppressed by, without having that anxious about the question. We ask it.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't get it immediately, we just let it go for a minute and then... go back to it, because that's you talk about the essence we are, and when we are a child, we realize that we know who we are when we are a child, and if we go back to that memory, we can have a little glimpse of what we really are without being asking that.
That you are wise and you have that memory.
Is that possible?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have to be a practice of great anxiety and struggle.
No, because I speak like this. Sorry.
And there are different moments, too. You know, sometimes it's no problem to look into it. Sometimes it's wonderful to look into it because we love discovery. Sometimes it's frustrating because we don't feel like we're getting anywhere. You know, there's all kinds of possibilities. And, you know, all I can say is that the moment when we do realize it is, you know, absolute, total relief. You know, it's like, oh, right, of course. It's like some cosmic joke that's been played on us. You know?
And we also practice Zazen that will give us some space of tranquility to look.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why yesterday when we were talking about sitting straight and just being here and really returning to the moment, and then I said, okay, so everybody's stable now and we can then take this.
You know,
it's in those moments where it's great to ask. Sometimes people say, oh, no, I'm feeling so good. I don't want to ask the koan, you know, I don't want to disturb it. But it's exactly in those moments where it's good to bring the koan, to bring the question, to say, who am I? Who's feeling good? And then might be disturbed, the feeling good. Or it might not, you know. It can also be in moments of great distress. Who's feeling distressed? Ordinary moments of who's showering, you know, who's eating, whatever. So, right, it does not have to be some big
struggle.
Yeah.
I think it touched on something. I think you said that when you're in those moments of peaceful, kind of straight sitting and all of that, that then the koan disturbs it, or can disturb it. But then, so an attachment to a good thing is still an attachment.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Of having
an attachment to a good feeling, good
right.
thing, attachment
to this good,
it's
peaceful
still,
feeling.
Ah, yeah,
it's
yeah.
still an attachment.
No, that was the question I was going to make. It. I mean, can you also not be attached to the answer that you have given?
Yeah, sure.
That's where you are. Okay, fantastic. I've done this exam, so.
Right, exactly. And that, again, that's
I'm
why
so
we
good
have.
With that.
That's why we have another koan. Because then you start over again. It's like, oh,
yeah.
Okay. I don't know.
But the answer doesn't change when you find an answer for a koan, is that's the answer, or not?
What?
I mean, if you do the koan later, might the answer change, or you find it the same, always the same answer? If you go through it, I've never done it, so you always find the same answer, or once you find it, it's.
Well, it depends what you mean. Again, you ask these good questions. What is the same answer? You know,
well,
what are we referring to?
Yeah,
about
I don't
the same
know
answer?
What the answer is, but I'm wondering if you would find the same one.
Well, I tell you, you know, I did all these koans myself with my teacher, and for 20 years, more than 20 years, so for 24 years now, I've been working with other people on koans. So I've gone through these koans, you know, like hundreds of times. Every single time, someone walks in and they say to me, my koan is this. I throw away everything I know about that koan, and I pass that koan again with them. So the essence of, you know, the true nature is always true, but how that manifests is different every time. For me, you know, having done these koans so many times with people, and for other people, because sometimes, you know, we have a koan, and then it gets repeated in another collection later. And I ask people to do it again. They say, oh, I already did that koan. I say, no, do it again. And they have a different experience of it then. Mm-hmm. So when we're saying it's the same answer, we're thinking of it like, okay, so what time of day is it? Or, you know, what color is that chair or something? Well, it's always red, you know. That's not what the answer is like.
But it can be different manifestation, but same meaning, same pointing, the same nature.
Right. But if we then think, okay, when I passed this coin before, this is what I did, this is what I saw, then we're just stuck somewhere. So
yeah.
We have to like start over. That's why I have to like start over with people when someone comes in with a coin. Completely start over. And, you know, what is moo? I start over. Start over.
Yeah, there's a story. I don't recall completely. But this, the teacher asks the monk something, like, what's this moment? I don't know. And the monk says something like, the pine trees in the yard. And So what it is, the pine trees in the yard. So it's the same words, but...
Yeah.
It's about this koan. I also have something that maybe it's a little bit intellectual that I'm saying, but I think this, it's interesting that you said we have now to shift because he's not a true man, he's a true person, because we live in another time. We take into consideration other aspects. But anyway, true person and true man, why not true being? That's my question when I was listening to it. Is reducing it to the human condition in a way?
Good question too, you know. So he's saying that this, if he says true being, then we're like shifting onto this absolute, we're focusing on the absolute, and we're not taking into account the human aspect. He's saying it's coming and going in the gates of your face. So it's here and now. There is a true person of no rank, here and now. If he says, you know, there's a true being, then we start getting ethereal, maybe, and we drift from here.
It seems
here.
That excludes, I mean, obviously, the famous Cohen as a dog in Buddha nature, I think, is a dog or a beast. It rises me this question. I mean, perhaps we are the hands more enlightened than we, because they don't think, they don't have the conceptual mind.
You know, this too, you know, we say, well, humans are the only animal that is aware of their imminent death, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we really know that.
No?
I don't know. And it doesn't, but when we see the true person of no rank, we see that the dog too is the true person of no rank. I mean, that the dog is not better or worse than us, you know. It includes all beings in that. But the way that we experience it is through this vehicle that we have. This is how we manifest. This is our place in the world, right? So this is how we experience it. It's through this vehicle. It's limited, this vehicle, this vessel, say. And yet it's all we have. If we didn't, we wouldn't be experiencing what we're experiencing.
Okay, sorry. What I was going to say is that don't you think this conceptual dimension of our condition, human condition, precludes this direct experience that animals can have, like ants or the dogs or something? I mean,
I really don't know, because I don't know how ants and dogs.
Well, definitely they don't have a concept. We think they don't have a conceptual mind. They act out of their instinct, as we say, and they have this direct experience with life.
So let's say that, I don't know if it precludes is what I would use, but I would say it is...
what is precludes?
So you mean an impediment? Is that what you mean? Yeah. Sorry, that's what you said in Portuguese, yeah. It is, in that sense. It is something that we have to work with, that it's part of our condition. We have to work with it. I would say, can we work with it? Because can we hold both the conceptual mind and the not conceptual? Can we hold those both? Because that's who we are. The problem is we focus so much and we become so attached to the conceptual mind that then it becomes an obstacle to realizing otherwise. But it doesn't have to be an obstacle. It absolutely does not. And it's not, actually. Once we have seen through it and seen that it's not the master of our mind, that this other aspect of our mind, of our being, is also important, is also, and in one includes the other, actually. But when we focus only on the conceptual mind, then we miss, then it does become an impediment. That's true, yeah. Absolutely. It doesn't have to, though. You know, we use words, so we use poetry, we use art, and I sit here and talk, you know, and that all of that is trying to express the non-conceptual. And sometimes it does, you know, marvelously. Sometimes it doesn't. Art, sometimes it really achieves it. Sometimes it really does, as we know. Poetry, music... can we put concepts to the work of realizing the non-conceptual, maybe something like that?
Good.
I've done this question before. I still don't know. But this is a simple question. In our retreats, some of our retreats, by the end, we kind of manifestate our creative answer or expression. And what is that pointing to? I think that's pointing to something.
that I should get and I don't get.
What do you mean that?
I mean in Zen retreats, in our Zen retreat, a lot of stuff to do dies. the samu, the rituals, they all point for something, and we should take with us and do it in our day-to-day life. And by the end of some retreats, we do that creative...
We celebrate.
Celebrate, yeah. In a creative expression, collectively, why?
Mm-hmm.
By tradition, I think. In the other Zen, the Zen in Lisbon, the Zen Dojo Zen, in Sevilla, they also do that.
Yeah.
I don't know, in America. And I think that they, it's pointing for something that I think that I don't really get.
Well, I'm assuming that they have the same, you know, approach as I do. I know there's Tibetan retreats that happens into. Like, you know, a month-long Tibetan retreat, and then they end with some kind of celebration and creative expression like that as well. Yeah. Because we've sat all these hours and hours and hours, we've, you know, become more stable, like the jar of dirty water has been set down and we can see more clearly. A lot of our tight places have eased, we're more comfortable. And this creativity emerges, you know. There's
mm-hmm.
That's where creativity comes from letting go of fixed ideas and positions. The best artists, for example, they do not become attached to how it should be done. They just let emerge what emerges,
mm-hmm.
And it's a wonderful way of expressing another aspect of the practice and manifesting it in a different way. I talk about these supposedly children's movies, Inside Out.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about these before, right? So in one of them, I can't remember if it's the first or the second, but if you haven't seen it, it's kind of hard to understand, but two emotions get lost, right?
Uh-huh.
So it's joy and sorrow.
No, it's in the first one.
Right. I think it's first one. Yeah.
It's in the first one. Yeah.
Right.
One of my daughter's lost.
But I can't remember this incident, but maybe it is. And they get lost and they, you know, meet this, you know, part of the girl's mind that has been repressed. It's like her childhood imaginary friend,
mm-hmm.
right, that has become lost. And they're trying to get back to the headquarters of the mind, you know, the self that's controlling everything. And it's a long way and it's complicated to get there, and this repressed character who's friendly and nice and really wants to come back and see the girl again, but the girl has been like my imaginary friend, she doesn't even remember him anymore, you know. And he says, oh, you know, there's a shortcut to get back to the headquarters. And so they go, okay, and so they start walking there and they see the entrance and it says the tunnel of abstract thought.
Art is so good.
And they're terrified. So happiness quickly says, no way.
Exactly.
No way. We're not going into the tunnel of abstract thinking. No way. And sorrow is kind of like, oh, well, I'll do whatever we have to do. And you know, the imaginary friend is like, yeah, this is the best place to go. Let's go in there, you know? So finally they do, because the other way gets blocked or something. So they go through this tunnel of imaginary thought. And it's amazing. I don't know what children understand it, but I think we talked about this already last summer. Yeah. And it's amazing what happens, because these, you know, it's a cartoon. So the characters like start dissolving and they look like cubist figures. And their faces melt, you know? And they... They're all of who they think they are is falling apart. You know? They go through this abstract thought. Now, you know, abstract thinking is kind of, you know, but that's what happens too, you know. With abstract thinking, we aren't in the concrete anymore, right? So they go through it and they come out, and the way out of the tunnel is through creativity. So the abstract thinking leads to creativity. So letting go of the fixed ideas and the attachments we have to the concrete, that's where creativity is. And so, and we see, you know, that flourishing that emerges in the end of the retreat like that.
Yeah, I'm very glad for asking the question, because yeah, it's pointing to that. If we, if we, the jar gets cleared, what we can do from emptiness? No, then I'm stuck with this word now. from there. Yeah, it's a well.
Yeah, it's a wonderful. I love it. I don't want to do it every time, though, because then it becomes kind of a formula, and we kind of do the same stuff every time. So I try to have it when it has some meaning, celebration.
It's time,
And in the second movie, it comes the anxiety.
What?
In the second movie, there is the anxiety.
That's right.
And I thought, oh my God, I lived this girl in my head all my life.
Those are wonderful films.
They're so wonderful. I love them.
I tried to convince my teacher to see them.
Really?
Wait, can you see them?
She was like, oh, no, I don't watch children's movies. And I said, no, go. See it. I don't know if she did.
I think it's in Disney that I have.
Where can you
see it? Disney Channel.
I saw them in the cinema. Theater.
But then they repeat the
And you can only see it on Disney?
No, I think you can.
I'm not sure because I'm not.
You can rent it.
Yeah, you can probably rent it.
You can rent it.
Probably. And I don't know, what are they called in Portuguese?
It's not that.
No.
Divertidamente.
What does that mean?
Divertidamente.
In a funny way.
Double sense. In a funny way, but D, it's two, and invert, and mind.
Ment is mind.
Interesting.
It's like uncomplicated, the mind, in a funny way.
Oh, interesting. Good. Yeah, because it's a challenge to translate those. I mean, I can never remember what the title is in English and what it is in French because I confuse them. They're both in English, but I guess for the French they decided. Does anyone know what is it in English?
Inside Out.
Inside Out, yeah.
Inside Out.
Okay.
And in French?
In French it's vice versa.
Ah, vice versa.
Which we also say in English, vice versa. I think it's about lunchtime, right?
It's 1:32.
Okay, perfect. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.